Welcome to the Better Birth Podcast. My name's Erin and I'm a hypnobirthing and antenatal instructor, birth activist and all-round birth geek. In this podcast, I chat to experts in the field of pregnancy and birth, debunking myths around birth, diving into the research around maternity care and exploring what is it that means you're more likely to have a positive birthing experience. If you enjoy this podcast, do feel free to buy me a coffee and fund my caffeine habit. Link to my Buy Me a Coffee page is in the podcast info. Enjoy this episode. Welcome to the Better Birth Podcast. Today, I am going to be speaking to the very wonderful and lovely friend, Dr. Jenna Broff, about compassion fatigue in midwifery. So welcome, Jenna. Do you want to introduce yourself to anybody that hasn't listened to your previous episodes that you very kindly recorded with me?
Yes, thank you, Erin. I think, is this number three? I think
it is number three, yeah.
Third one for yours, and then you kindly repaid the favour and came on my podcast to talk about your experiences. So for those that don't know me, I'm Dr. Jenna Broff. I'm a perinatal clinical psychologist, and I specialise in maternity care trauma and pregnancy after trauma, pregnancy after loss, and supporting and challenging systems that contribute to psychological harm in their staff and in pregnant people and their families.
Which is such important work and so, so, so needed, by the way. So I'm really glad that you've come back on again, because we were talking before we started recording about, you know, how we could probably record a few episodes on kind of related topics, because there's so much to talk about. But we are going to focus on compassion fatigue in midwifery today. So for those that are listening and don't know what compassion fatigue is, do you want to start off by explaining what it is?
So compassion fatigue is essentially the cost of caring, is what it's been described as. And essentially, when we are in a role that requires a lot of empathy, and that we sort of lean into or go into because we're very empathic. So we're a helper, or, and I say we because that is, you know, I'm not a midwife, I'm a psychologist, but we are also helpers. When you go into those roles because you're an empathic person and the role requires that connection and that empathy, we do not have an infinite supply of compassion and empathy. And actually, when so much suffering is happening and we're having to be empathic to everybody's suffering, the tank essentially runs empty at some point, and we are fatigued by the amount of compassion that is necessary and that we want to give and that is expected of us in our role. So that is what compassion fatigue is. And as I said, it's a phenomenon that's been used to describe what happens for carers and help people in helping professions particularly.
Yeah, so definitely is going to affect midwives in particular, because mm-hmm. they are in that caring role, and we know the state of maternity care is dire at the minute, and they are seeing a lot of trauma and traumatic experiences. Is it a case of almost kind of being desensitized to things, or is that a different thing?
So compassion fatigue, once upon a time, it was related to or used as an interchangeable term for burnout. So originally it was sort of compassion fatigue / burnout were sort of said to be the same thing or very similar. And actually now that's been sort of debunked or distinguished, or they've been separated out. So burnout is the product of just the amount of effort, general effort, energy and resource that is used for any one task, but if we're thinking occupationally in terms of work. And now we see compassion fatigue compared more to vicarious trauma or secondary trauma. And actually, compassion fatigue can happen as a result of trauma, but it's sort of less of a, it's like the diffuse impact or the cumulative impact of seeing so much suffering. Whereas I would distinguish secondary trauma or vicarious trauma as sort of more aligned with the PTSD of relating to a specific scenario. And I think that that's, you know, might not be helpful to distinguish them, but I think that's one of the best ways to distinguish them. So compassion fatigue can occur without PTSD, without seeing things, like without having those traditional symptoms, whereas vicarious trauma or secondary trauma is now used as more of a name to explain the PTSD ex type of experiences and symptoms that are experienced by people who witness or are around traumatic experiences.
So what does compassion fatigue look like when we're thinking about maternity care and thinking about midwives and the way that they behave and the way that they care for pregnant people?
So what it looks like in terms of this, if you like, symptoms, I'm not a medical professional in that sense, so I don't really ascribe to sort of a checklist of symptoms. But actually, when you look at the impact of compassion fatigue, it is very similar, like how we see it in terms of how it affects the person who is fatigued. It's very similar to burnout, as you know, and depression, and you know, many other mental health presentations. So irritability, lack of sleep, lack of appetite, anger, tearfulness, disconnecting from previous sort of hobbies and things that would sustain someone and things that people would find pleasurable, withdrawal, so changing eating habits, changing libido, like they're all very common, like they're very common. And I guess the thing that distinguishes compassion fatigue is sort of why it's happening. And then I guess when we look at the impact that then has on the care that they're giving, which is, I think, is what you were sort of leading to, isn't it? So what there's lots talked about the disconnection element in compassion fatigue. And actually, someone has termed, I've read that it's been termed psychic numbing. And that is, as the number of people who are suffering increases, so if we think about the system and maternity care and rising rates of birth trauma and the amount of suffering that we see in people in their birth, in the perinatal period, empathy and the willingness to help decreases. And so the person who is fatigued, because they don't have a finite, an infinite resource of compassion, is more disconnected, is less able to be with people in their suffering, is less able to respond to people's suffering, and is less able to form those connections that might actually prevent some of the trauma. So actually, it has a huge, huge impact on the care and the capacity of the professional, of the midwife, in being able to help people who are struggling and to do their job in a way that is going to be protective for people who are going to, you know, are going through or may go through a difficult birth experience, or they don't have that compassion. So it's very, the impact is huge on the person who experiences it and on the people who are being cared for by those experiencing it.
Yeah, and I think this is it's such a huge, I think this is a huge issue actually. You know, we talk a lot about the system and the policies and the guidelines and you know the kind of top down issues that are affecting care in pregnancy and birth, but compassion fatigue, I think, is a massive issue and a massive driver of trauma, birth trauma for pregnant people and trauma for midwives as well. And we see this as birth workers all the time. You know, the amount of
pregnant people that we may support or that might message me in my DMs, and they'll talk about how their midwife was really standoffish or really dismissive or really impatient or rude. And I think a lot of that, the root cause is compassion fatigue, isn't it?
Yeah, and actually, I can't remember the source, and it's multiple sources, but at one point, when sort of burnout slash compassion fatigue was being sort of recognized, some of the advice and the guidelines that were put out there, not specific to midwifery generally, but to health professionals, was that actually prevent compassion fatigue and burnout by being more disconnected in the first place. So it was talking about it as a don't connect to people. And be more distant and be more numb to suffering, so then you don't get burnt out. So it was actually, to me, it's not a nuanced response, of course. And it's, yeah, so it's either don't get involved in the first place or get so involved and then you'll be disconnected in the end. Again, there's no nuance there, there's no recognition of what needs to change in terms of compassion satisfaction, from a systemic perspective and from supporting staff. So when we think about compassion, we think about three things. So in psychology, we have the creator of a therapy called compassion-focused therapy and compassionate mind work is Paul Gilbert. He's a psychologist. And if anyone's interested in this as a topic, there are a couple of people that I would recommend to read about. So anything by Paul Gilbert, anything by Dr. Chris Irons, and anything by, I think it's Kristin Neff, but it could be Kirsten Neff. I always get those mixed up. But essentially, when we think about compassion, we need to think about what we always think about others, self to others. So we always think about the compassion that we give to other people, particularly as health professionals. But actually, we need to think about others to self and self to self. So there's actually three ways in which compassion functions in our lives. And the others to self is around the working conditions, around the system, around the guidelines, around the policies and the things that either enable or prevent staff from being able to be compassionate to others in a sustainable way, or and also be compassionate to themselves. And when we think about self to self compassion, like I said, there's things around the system that make that difficult, but then there's also things around society in terms of, women in particular being conditioned to self-sacrifice and to meet everyone else's needs before their own. And this idea that if you work in, the NHS in particular, it's a duty. It's this, this is your duty. And then if we look more at if we go, so that's sort of like the macro level, if we go a little bit more inward, we can think about the sort of teams and not letting other people down, and then the real bare bones of not having enough staff and everybody having to give over and above what is in their tank to be able to keep things going. So there's so much there that we need to think about that isn't as simple as just don't give everything to your. It's completely, it just completely goes, flies in the face of what we should be doing, and is so sort of black and white, in terms of just give less.
I think it'd be quite overwhelming for a healthcare worker or a midwife to kind of recognize that they potentially have compassion fatigue and that they're not ultimately giving pregnant people and women the best of them and the best care that they can be giving. And obviously you've talked about, kind of on a systemic level and, staff shortages and all these other things, which are quite huge national issues, which as an individual and as an individual midwife working in the system, you can't do very much about. So, and I think, the preventative aspect that you just mentioned is probably not the right or the best approach to preventing compassion fatigue. So what would you suggest if there's, for example, student midwives who are going into the system and maybe aren't, you know, fatigued by you know, well, they probably are already actually, depending on if they're year one or year three. But, you know, if they're going into the system, what things can they do to kind of prevent them getting fatigued in the first place?
And so, in terms of prevention, so I do quite a bit of teaching for student midwives, and we think about things like this. And there is actually some evidence, and there was an article published in the British Journal of Midwifery around compassionate mind training. And it says training, it's not training, so to speak, but compassionate mind work for student midwives as a means of heightening levels of compassion towards self and others. So that's obviously thinking about preventative work and supporting a recognition of compassion being self to self as well as self to others. And as you said, the others to self is a thing that we have very little control over. So that's one thing. So if anyone works for a midsoc, or if anyone teaches on any of the training programs for midwives around the country, I would definitely recommend trying to find some compassionate mind work, a psychologist or a therapist who is trained in compassion focused work to come in and to give that to your student midwives. It's different. We don't have time to go into it today, but it's different to resilience training. What we see on programs is resilience training. It's a very corporate invested thing at the moment. And actually, when we think about the caring professions, compassion is the key in lots of this. So I would definitely recommend that. I would recommend that student midwives make use of the support that they find helpful. So, I mean, it's an absolute travesty that midwives don't have clinical supervision anymore. In my role, I offer in the NHS and in private practice, offer clinical supervision and reflective practice space to midwives. And I think that that's really important. And if student midwives have that through mentorship schemes, you know, find that and get into a good, healthy habit of having that. Because if you speak to any psychologist, they will tell you that they couldn't do the job that they do for long effectively without supervision. Mm-hmm. So just for example, I have a professional supervisor, which is sort of thinking more about like my role and like the wider issues in my role and my profession. And then I have a clinical supervisor where I discuss my cases. And then I have like peer supervision. So that's sort of like the support from other people who are in the same position as me. And I know that I'm very privileged to have that. But as psychologists, because we understand things like compassion fatigue and vicarious trauma and yeah, how precious those things are to preserve, we have supervision. And actually, I wouldn't be able to stay registered as a psychologist on the official register without that. So it's an absolute travesty that midwives don't have supervision in terms of afforded to them overall. So I would seek that out if that's something that you can afford, or that's a network that you can make, or there's an opportunity for that, definitely. Mm. In terms of prevention, and also in terms of support if you're feeling compassion fatigued.
Yeah. So if a midwife identifies that potentially they are compassion fatigued and it's too late to prevent because it's already happened, then what would you recommend that they do to get support and to deal with that?
And again, this could well be like, again, a postcode lottery situation, which I guess you probably have so many conversations about if it's available in your area. So, you know, some acute trusts have good staff wellbeing services with therapists, counsellors and psychologists who understand compassion fatigue, you know, occupational health. It's sometimes staff wellbeing, sometimes occupational health. Definitely seek that out. There's a drive for more sort of perinatal psychologists or maternity psychologists to be involved in offering staff support. If you're thinking about sort of self-help, I would definitely be starting to look at any of the sort of more accessible books by Paul Gilbert. Let me see if I can find one on my shelf. So there's this book called by Paul Gilbert, just called The Compassionate Mind, and it talks about self-compassion, and it's just, obviously the compassion Bible. Yeah, and there are other authors that don't come off the tip of my tongue. Oh, my books just fell off the shelf. Yeah, there are other authors who talk about compassion. Compassionate mind training, compassion-focused therapy, compassion-focused self-help, specifically for helping professionals. I don't know if there's anything published specifically for midwifery, but if someone's listening and they want to do that, that would be a great idea. So yeah, I guess there's a variety of things. I mean, from taking in a very, not very extreme view, but one of the hardest things is to, and I have people in my DMs, and I'm sure you have people in your DMs, and I know people like Kemi have people in their DMs, is recognizing that actually being compassionate to yourself is about recognizing if this works for you, and if the system isn't going to get better, or if there isn't anything that can change in the system. And I don't mean at like a huge wide wait for the policies to change, wait for the investment. I mean, is there anything that you can change about your role, your working environment, the tasks that you do, the hours that you do, the shifts that you do, the boundaries? If there's anything that can't, if everything can't change, if nothing can change, should I say, sorry, actually how being compassionate to yourself is to not stay in that environment. And this isn't unique to midwifery. So I hear from sort of psychologists who are working, I'm very lucky in the jobs that I work in, but from other NHS staff, other healthcare professionals who are finding that the systems are such that actually it being compassionate is walking away. And that's a really hard thing. But without changing that, are you going to continue to do or end up very quickly back where you were not giving the care, not able to give the care, for reasons other than compassion fatigue, but also because of compassion fatigue? Like, can you be the person that you want to be and need to be for yourself and for your patients in this environment?
And
And
I
I know it's not easy to leave, like I know it's not as simple as I can leave this, but it's a very a reality for a few, a few hundred people, I don't know, but I'm just, and I'll know you'll have DMs like that, and we hear stories from people who used to be in this work in the system who no longer do, who say that exact thing. I don't know if you're going to reference an episode in particular, but yeah.
Yeah, we, I mean, we, I mean, I get lots of, I get DMs from student midwives who are identifying that they don't think that they can emotionally continue with midwifery because they recognize that it's too stressful, it's too, it's affecting their mental health. And for some people, that is the right decision, and it's heartbreaking because we know we're so short-staffed with midwives that we don't want midwives to leave the profession. But for some people, that is the right choice. And you do have to ask if you're that fatigued emotionally and empathetically by doing that job, are you doing the best job, or are you causing harm? And I think some midwives, and I don't think it's unfair to say this, that some midwives are causing harm because they are so fatigued by doing that job that they aren't giving the best care that they could, and they are, some of them are causing trauma. They are causing harm. And I think some introspective, view of yourself and why you went into that profession and whether you're still doing what you set out to do, I think is really important.
And in terms of if people are thinking, I think I'm there, I'm sort of there, or I'm heading there. They're the people that tend to reach out for help, or they're at the point of no return and they've made their exit or they're planning an exit. But I think that all of these things, like self-reflection, emotional regulation, enhancing self-compassion, finding meaning in work and life, and reevaluating where you are and making changes if you can, and setting healthy emotional boundaries, engaging in healthy lifestyle activities, which I know sounds a bit trite, but nutrition and sleep are really important. Making connections for support and having meaningful support, even if it's not afforded through official routes. And also seeking out support when there are particularly traumatic events, because obviously compassion fatigue, burnout, and vicarious trauma can all co-occur, and someone can experience all three, which would be entirely horrendous. But sort of we know that sort of support after particularly traumatic events are protective for not only the development of vicarious trauma, but also the sort of longer term trajectory of compassion fatigue. And there's, when we think about compassion, we think about a balance between empathy and mindfulness and being able to put boundaries around our emotional investment, not overinvest and not do not invest at all, but being able to put boundaries around our emotional investment in our patients specifically and in our work as a whole. And that takes practice. It's not a flip of the switch type situation. Changing the environment and things that can afford those that space is great, but it does take practice, and they're the sort of things that, why therapy is not a magic wand. It's all practice, and they're the things that people need to work on. So it is tough.
But there is things that they can, people can do.
There is, yeah.
You have to take the first step to recognize that that's the point that you've reached, and that's where you are. And that's why I think recording this is important, because I think there's probably people out there that maybe aren't quite so self-aware and haven't identified that perhaps they've reached that point, and might listen to this and maybe kind of have a light bulb moment and think, actually, maybe I do need to seek some support or start making some changes, some positive changes. So
Some of the things that people may, because to be fair, as I described, the symptoms are quite common across various mental health presentations, burnout also. I think particularly with compassion fatigue, the early stages of compassion fatigue, people may identify sort of on the journey into compassion fatigue an over investment in their clients. So taking work home with you, that type mentality. And I don't mean taking actual work home with you. I mean taking the thoughts and the emotions and the weight of the work home with you. And so sort of recognizing that you are overinvesting and you are sort of ruminating, worrying about people a lot, and you're unable to switch off from that, to me is like an orange flag, if you like. Like this, I'm heading down this road, and actually that is the perfect point to pull back and to think, right, okay, who can I draw on here? Obviously, I know clinical supervision has gone for midwifery, but there is the PMOs, so the professional midwifery advocates, PMAs, PMOs, PMO is something totally different. PMAs, so professional midwifery advocates who offer from my experience, really good, compassionate, caring support, and they're sort of accessible on more of an ad hoc basis. But please find out who your PMAs are in your trust, and speak to them. And they can offer sort of they can facilitate all sorts of things in terms of sort of changes to work patterns, as well as that space.
yeah.
So that's something else that I'd recommend.
Thank you so much for today. I think it's been a really important topic. Is there anything that we have not mentioned or covered that you wanted to mention before we finish off for today?
No, I think that there is so much that's sort of interlinked, so which we said, so potentially we'll record again on those other things, because yeah, like the prevalence of them is sort of all common, but the ways in which I would advise people seeking support or treatment or yeah, or prevention would be different, I guess, across sort of burnout, compassion fatigue, and vicarious or secondary trauma. So yeah, it's more about these sort of nuanced separate conversations we decided, didn't we? Yeah, so if you recognize some of this in yourself, you know, please reach out to whoever you feel can support you with that. And just know that it's that there are people who are working to try and make the changes from the other to self experience of compassion, and that you're doing the best you can with the knowledge you've got at the time, which is it's oh that is like the bingo, you know, the bingo thing in therapy, like helping people to recognize that they did the best they could with the information and the resources that they had at the time. You know, guilt and shame are the opposite to compassion. And actually, you know, you said about there are midwives causing harm. If people are recognizing that in themselves, know that being compassionate in response to that and understanding and forgiving yourself, and then using that to spur or motivate change in terms of getting that support, is the way forward.
Yeah. You share so much amazing content online. Where can people find you if they want to read more about the work that you do?
Yeah, so I'm not omnipresent on Instagram. Don't post much content, to be fair. But I'm on Instagram as Dr. Jenna Psychologist. If you search for me, that's how you'll find me. And I also have a website which is the same name, Dr. Jenna Psychologist. And I have a podcast which is not specific to midwifery, but it's thinking about the sort of perinatal struggles and the growth and the transformation. And that's the Perinatal Podcast Growing Through.
Amazing. Thank you so much for your time today, Jenna. And I really hope this episode has helped both maternity staff to self-reflect and seek support, and also to help pregnant people understand maybe a little bit better the interactions that they're having with midwives. So I really, really appreciate your time today.
Thanks for me.
The Better Birth podcast and all of its content is for educational and informational purposes only. You should consult your midwife or your doctor for anything in relation to your own pregnancy and birth. The opinions and the views of the guests on the Better Birth podcast are their own opinions and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Better Birth or Erin Fung.